down to the last day, even the last hour now. I'm an old man, lonely and unloved, sick and hurting, tired of living. I'm ready for the hereafter. It has to be better than this. I own a tall glass building in which I sit, and 97% of the company housed in it. And the land around it, for half a mile in three directions, and 2,000 people who work here, and another 20,000 people who do not. And I own the pipeline under the land that brings gas to the building from my fields in Texas. And I own utility lines and deliver electricity. And I lease the satellite unseen miles above by which I once barked commands to my empire flung around the world. My assets exceed $11 billion. I own silver in Nevada and copper in Montana, coffee in Kenya, coal in Angola, rubber in Malaysia, natural gas in Texas, crude oil in Indonesia, and steel in China. My company owns companies that produce electricity and make computers and build dams and print paperbacks and broadcast signals to my satellite. I have subsidiaries with divisions in more countries than anyone can find. I once owned all the appropriate toys, the yachts, the jets, and blondes, and homes in Europe, farms in Argentina, an island in the Pacific, thoroughbreds, even a hockey team. But I've grown too old for toys. The money is the root of my misery. I had three families, three ex-wives who bore seven children, six of whom are still alive and doing all they can to torment me. To the best of my knowledge, I fathered all seven and buried one. I should say his mother buried him. I was out of the country. I'm estranged from all my wives and all the children. They're gathering today because I'm dying, and it's time to divide the money. With that, John Grisham begins his novel, The Testament. As you read that introduction from John Grisham, Grisham, as any good writer, understands the power of a good introduction. You find yourself wondering as you read through those words, what's going to happen to this old man? How long before he dies? And what will happen with his family? And where is this all going? And knowing that John Grisham always writes about attorneys, how do they fit in to this dividing up the inheritance? John Grisham is a best-selling author for a reason. He understands how literature works. He realizes that if he doesn't have an introduction that grabs attention, he may not sell his book. And places like Barnes & Noble and Borders will have way too many copies of his book, or they won't buy him to begin with. Good authors understand that introductions are crucial to what they write. Now, I explain that to you because it's interesting to me, as we open the pages of the New Testament, how uninteresting the introduction to the New Testament is. As you turn your Bibles to the first chapter in Matthew's Gospel, you wonder, did Matthew know anything about writing when he wrote this book? I mean, as you turn there, and I invite you to do that, you discover that Matthew begins with 17 verses that are basically just a list of names. I mean, John Grisham could teach Matthew a thing or two if he had the opportunity, or so we think. I'm a believer that God's Word is inspired. That what Matthew wrote wasn't just what Matthew wanted written, but it was what God wanted Matthew to write. So if I complain about Matthew's introduction, I'm really wondering, what did God have in mind when he started out the whole New Testament with this list of names. He says, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah. Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez. Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. Has it grabbed your attention yet? David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Ammon. Ammon, the father of Josiah. Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers, the time of the exile to Babylon. I see you. You're on the edge of your seats. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Achim. Achim, the father of Elihud. Elihud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Matthan. Matthan, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who's called Christ. Thus, there were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to Christ. Now, let's face it, most of us, when we open up the Gospel of Matthew, we just skip over those 17 verses and we get right to the good stuff. We start our Advent readings with the story of Jesus. We skip over all this stuff about all these names. So why in the world, if they're so unimportant to us, were they important to Matthew? Why does he start out just right off the bat and make us wade through all these names? Well, I suppose one of our problems when it comes to appreciating how Matthew begins his gospel is that we live in a democracy. Living here in the United States, it really doesn't matter very much who your parents were and who their parents were. For the most part, with the exception of inheritances, we don't get a whole lot based on what our parents did. Their positions don't usually impact our position. But if you lived in Great Britain, you know that sometimes your lineage matters. I mean, right now, over in Great Britain, they're anticipating April 29th. It is the big day when William marries Kate. Now, people don't really care that much, I guess, about Kate Middleton's background. She's just a regular, ordinary person. But who she's marrying, William, Prince William, is second in line to the throne of England, and his history matters because he's in line to be king. And one of the things this boring list of names says to us is that Matthew wants to introduce us to a very extraordinary person. As you read through Matthew's gospel, you discover that Matthew has a slant on who Jesus is. He recognizes him not just as a teacher, not just as a good man, not even as a miracle worker. He sees him as a king. In fact, as you read through the gospel of Matthew, you really can't miss it. You remember the story that we reflect upon this time of year of the wise men, the magi who come to visit Jesus. Remember, they see the star and they interpret this as the star of somebody special. And so they show up in Jerusalem having followed this star, and their question to King Herod was, where is this king who was born the king of the Jews? We saw a star. And so these Gentile wise men show up to learn something about this king. And then Herod, having heard about this king, wants to wipe out this king because he's a threat to his empire. And as you go through the book, you discover that Jesus is the king of the Jews. He talks about the kingdom of heaven. It's a major theme of the book of Matthew. When he gets to the end of the book, you discover that Jesus stands before Pilate and he says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "Yes, it is as you say." And then at the very end of the book, Jesus stands on a mountain with his disciples and he says to them, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." He's not just a king. He is the king. And Matthew has helped us recognize that this king is important. He's got a royal lineage. And so just, if nothing else, to let us know that this is no ordinary person that Matthew's writing about, he wants us to note these names, which give status to Jesus. That's of some help, I suppose. But it's interesting, too, as you look at this strange list of names, that Matthew hasn't just randomly put the names down. I mean, he hasn't even just put them down in chronological order. He's organized the names. He gives us a list of names. First of all, he tells us in verse 1, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That's important in and of itself, and we'll look at that in a minute. But then he organizes these names into groups of 14. From Abraham to David are 14 names. From David to the exile in Babylon through Jeconiah, 14 names. From Jeconiah to Jesus, another 14 names. What's that all about? You discover as you read through this genealogy, that this is not a haphazard thing that Matthew has written. This is a very intentional, crafted, really work of art. That built into this, what Matthew has written here, is a whole message to us about who Jesus is and what he's come to do. I mean, obviously, we've already seen that he is a king. But Matthew wants us to see even more than that. He tells us he is the son of David, the son of Abraham. One thing you discover as you read through this list closely is that Matthew has selected the names in his list. We know that for a couple reasons. One, he begins Jesus' genealogy with Abraham. If you compare Matthew's genealogy of Jesus to Luke's genealogy of Jesus in Luke chapter 3, you discover there's quite a bit of difference between them. Most scholars believe that probably Matthew has given us Jesus' lineage through Joseph, and Luke has given us Jesus' lineage through Mary. And you discover that because as you get closer to the to Jesus, the names are totally different. But one of the things you notice as you compare those two lists is that in Luke traces Jesus' lineage back to Adam. Matthew just traces Jesus' lineage to Abraham. He's being selective. He's chosen to leave out a whole set of people who predated Abraham. We also discover that in this selective group, as he's grouped people in groups of 14, that he's left out a few different kings in Jesus' line. In verse 8, it says, the last part of verse 8, Jehoram was the father of Uzziah. Now, in the way that the Jews looked at lineage, that was appropriate. To say so-and-so was the father of someone else didn't necessarily mean that they were the immediate father of that person, but that they were the predecessor of that person. But if you go back to 1 Chronicles, chapters 22 through 26, and you look carefully, you discover that there's three kings that are listed in Chronicles that Matthew has left out of his list. I'm not completely sure why Matthew does that, but one of the reasons is apparent. He's trying to make this grouping of 14, 14, and 14 in each of the lists. He's trying to communicate something. And so he puts in the major players that were important to him in making his case. The reason I point that out is it's, if he's being selective, it's worthwhile to say, why does he include some and leave others out? We don't know the entire answer to that. There are a bunch of names in here we're really not that familiar with. But it is clear that he makes it clear that he is organizing this list around the number 14. Because not only can you count that, but in case we've missed it, he says, thus, verse 17, there were 14 generations from all of Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to Christ. So he's organizing this list to make a point. Matthew wants us to understand two very important things. Jesus is in the line of Abraham, and Jesus is in the line of David. That is, Jesus' lineage here is traced back to Abraham. Why? Because Matthew wants to be clear that Jesus is the king in the line of the Jews. Abraham was the father of the Jews. And so he goes back, not to Adam, the father of all mankind, but to Abraham, the father of the Jews, and says, Jesus can be traced back to Abraham. And the promises made to Abraham all come through Jesus. And when God said to Abraham, in you and through you, all the world will be blessed, Jesus is part of the answer to that. And when he promises him a seed that will do great things, Jesus, we know from the Apostle Paul, was the seed that Abraham was promised. So Matthew is saying, this king is the king of the Jews. And he's the king who goes back to the promises God made to Abraham. And he's the king who's in the line of King David. And this lineage shouts David throughout. One of the reasons we know that is David is mentioned at the beginning, he's mentioned in the middle, and in the number 14, the number 14 is David's number. In the Hebrew alphabet, each letter has a numerical value. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, He, Vav, Zion, it goes on. Dalet, it's the fourth letter of the alphabet. It corresponds to the number four. Vav is the sixth letter of the alphabet. The name David is spelled in Hebrew with the consonants Dalet, Vav, Dalet, David. And so you have 4, 6, 4. And you mathematicians, you add that up and it is the number 14. So every time he speaks of 14 generations, Matthew is saying, Jesus is in the line of David. Jesus is in the line of David. Jesus is a king in the line of David. He wants us to understand that Jesus is a king. But he's not just any king. He is the king. He's the king that was anticipated from the time of Abraham, from the time of the monarchs. He was the one the prophets prophesied about. 14 generations. Isaiah wrote, "Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." Jeremiah says, "In those days, at that time, I will make a righteous branch sprout from David's line. He will do it just and right in the land." Amos says, "In that day, I will restore David's fallen shelter. I will repair its broken walls and restore its ruins and will rebuild it as it used to be." Matthew is saying, David's throne is over and done with. But the promises of restoration come through Jesus. He is the one that we were anticipating. So, in this this grouping of names, Matthew is telling us a great deal, actually, about Jesus. He is king, not just any king, the promised one, the king of the Jews, the one who is the promised Christ, he says, the Messiah, the one prophesied for hundreds of years. And then, as you look at this list, among many other things you could notice, you discover that if Matthew's being selective about the people he chooses, that there are people in this list who are famous, and there are people that are not so famous, and then there are people who are infamous. I mean, of course, you have Abraham. He's the foundation of this family tree. And you have David, who is the one that the line builds up to. You have some great names in this list. But you also have Manasseh. Manasseh was one of the wickedest kings in all of Judah's history. I mean, as long as Matthew is going to leave a name or two out, why didn't he leave Manasseh's name out? But David's line goes through the wicked king Manasseh. There are famous people. There are infamous people. Even Judah, we're familiar with Judah's name. We're not necessarily as familiar with Judah's history. Judah was the brother of Joseph, one of the brothers who wanted to see his brother killed. And later on, Judah was also the brother who refused to carry on the family line. And so his daughter-in-law acted like a prostitute, got her father-in-law to have sex with her to carry on the family line. It's really kind of a scandal in the Old Testament. And Jesus came through that line, through that scandalous relationship. As you look through this, there are all kinds of different people. And even among famous, infamous, they're the not famous at all. I mean, there are people here, we have no idea who they are. And, you know, that's not unusual in God's economy. I mean, we like the heroes. We like to put the people up on the pedestals. But most of us are just ordinary people. That's what Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. He said, not many of you were wise. Not many of you were noteworthy when you were called. You're just ordinary people. Back then and now, God does some of his most amazing stuff through ordinary folks. But probably as you read through this list, if you're familiar with the lineage, the genealogies of the Old Testament, you discover one thing kind of jumps out at you in this list. That is that Matthew has included the names of certain women in this list. I mean, in that culture, in that day, the lines all went through the men. Women were not included in these genealogies. So the very fact that Matthew includes five different women in this list kind of jumps off the page. If you are aware of that cultural reality at all. We already noted one of those women, Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Judah. That's kind of a scandalous connection. And then in the verses that were in your bulletin, it says, verse 5, Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Interesting that Matthew notes those particular women. Rahab wasn't a Jew. She was a Canaanite. And yet, this Gentile is included in the line of the Jewish Messiah. As was Ruth, who was a Moabite, also a Gentile. Interesting that in the line of the Jewish king are a couple Gentile women who just stand out. I don't think that's coincidental at all. And then Tamar, we saw her relationship. And then there's this woman, well, Rahab, if you know her story, she was a prostitute. We don't usually make a big deal about that when we tell about Rahab to our children in Sunday school. But it's a fact. And then David has his son Solomon by this unnamed woman. In fact, her name is given to us as Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. David, in a moment of middle-aged lust, sees this woman who belongs to one of his soldiers, and he takes her, and he has sex with her, and they have a baby out of wedlock, and David chooses to have this soldier killed so that he can marry Bathsheba and hopefully cover up this whole scandal. It's a messy, messy thing. And all that is more than hinted at in Jesus' line. Matthew wants us to understand that when Jesus comes, he understands the mess of the world in which we live. He understands the sin in our lives and the sin of everyone. That's why he came. And Jesus came to break down these barriers of Jews and Gentiles, of men and women. All of that is just wrapped up in this family tree. And as Matthew tells the story, you discover that really what he's doing is he's giving us a history of Israel. I mean, the history of Israel can be summed up as God made promises to Abraham, and those promises came to their height in the kingship of David. But after David, people failed to follow God, and it seemed as if the promises of God were going to be forgotten. The land was invaded by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians, and the people were taken captive. It looked like it was all over. And even when people were restored to the land, they never had a monarchy again. They were always a captive country. There wasn't much hope. And so this goes from a place of promise to great hope to despair. And then Jesus is born. And that last woman is mentioned, Mary. I think Matthew tells us about these other women to focus our attention on the fact that Jesus mother Mary was an important person. And we know from the story in Matthew that Jesus' birth came about by the Holy Spirit coming upon Mary, and she became pregnant from the power of God in her life, not by a husband, Joseph. Matthew is saying so much in this story, in this lineage. He's really telling us a story. A story of a mess that people can make of their history, a mess that people can make of their lives, of the cost of sin, the cost of rebellion, and the whole reason why Jesus came. He was the Christ, the Messiah, the one who was promised. He was the one who came to make sense of it all, the one to bring forgiveness for sin, to bring hope to the world. What Jesus did for the people in Matthew's day is what he still does for us today. What we celebrate in this season is the fact that God has come into our world. That the ultimate solutions to the problems that we face as a society are ultimately not going to be political. They're not going to be some sort of great reform. At the heart and at the root, they're spiritual issues. Just this past week, Sue and I went to see a movie called Insider Job at the Jacob Burns Film Center. It's a kind of a documentary, really, about what happened that caused the financial meltdown in 2008. It's kind of a depressing documentary because as it explains the greed that brought down the system, among the things that it points out are that a lot of the failures in the system were caused by deregulation. That is, everything was deregulated. There were no rules, so basically greed prevailed, and in the prevalence of greed, everybody kind of took what they could and walked away, and very few people were prosecuted, or there were little grounds for prosecuting anyone. And even more discouraging and depressing about that film is they point out that pretty much the same people who got us into that mess are the people who are in charge right now. I think our tendency is to assume that some really smart people are going to resolve the issues that confront our society. Or the Democrats will do it, or the Republicans will do it, or somebody's going to come and get us out of this mess. Well, the reality is the problems that we face are bigger than political problems, bigger than financial problems. The greed, the power hunger that prevail in American society and all society ultimately are spiritual issues. And there's only one real solution to the sin of our society and the sin in your life and mine. And that is Jesus. And that's what this genealogy is all about. It's to bring us face to face with who we are, where we are, with our need as a society, with our need as individuals. Whatever we are facing, ultimately our hope goes beyond human strength. It comes down to that one who came into this world, born in a manger 2,000 years ago. He was the one promised to Abraham. He was the one promised to David. He's the one who brings hope to us today. And he is the one who came not just as a baby, but as a sacrifice for sin, to give us forgiveness and a new start in our lives so that we can have a relationship with God.